This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Covered in Pet Hair, a boozy show for pet lovers on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I have the pleasure to have a drink and a chat with the leading expert in separation anxiety in dogs for the second time. I will tell you all about her and introduce you as soon as we come back from these messages from our sponsors. Hi, I'm Isabel Alvarez-Arada, the host of Covered in Pet Hair. You know the expression, cats have nine lives? Well, what if you could give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying and neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Covered in Pet Hair. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I have the pleasure of having a drink and a chat with a pet parent, a dog trainer, a published author, an entrepreneur, a founder. She's a primary educator for dog professionals. She's a foodie, a wine snob, and a world traveler. She loves the ocean and considers herself a recovering workaholic. She's originally from San Francisco, currently lives in the California wine country. She's wife to Kevin, dog mom to Mabel and Teeny, who is now 15 years old. She is the leading expert in separation anxiety in dogs. She is Milena DiMartini. Welcome back, Milena. It's so good to see you.
I just love, you're so kind for all the words that you say, but yeah, I just love your smile, Isabel, and the fact that you're just as enthusiastic as I am. It makes me really like excited and yeah. Joyful.
Yeah. I know any opportunity I have to check in with you, I take as a blessing because you are the leading expert in something that affects so many pet parents. And I feel like there's still so much work to be done because people don't know that they are a pet parent to somebody with separation anxiety. And my goal with these interviews is always to entertain and educate. And you are the perfect entertainer and educator because you're such an expert, but you're also so personable. So thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me. I love this. And I'm with you. I want to get more education and information out there because it's just amazing to me how we've grown in education and awareness, but not to the extent that we need to. So more and more and more people need to know that there are positive ways to work with separation anxiety, and more people need to know that it even exists.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. So these people who might think they have bad behaving dogs, they just may just be dogs that have separation anxiety, especially like we spoke last time. And for those who are tuning in for the first time to an interview with Milena DiMartini, you should check out our first interview, which we did 3 years ago. And it is a basic kind of intro to separation anxiety. We're going to check in on some of that information and we're going to talk more about separation anxiety and how it affects different dogs in different stages of their life and different moments or experiences that they might go through. So before we get into all that, I want to introduce our drinking game today. So anybody participating in our drinking game at home, anytime you hear this word,
the secret word is fear.
Take a drink of whatever you're enjoying, but please be over 21 in the U.S. to partake. Never drink and drive and always drink responsibly. So what are you joining us with from the California wine country?
Well, it's not wine today, as a matter of fact. What I'm joining you with is called a separation anxiety soother spritz.
Ooh, I love that. What's in a separation anxiety soother spritz so that I can enjoy one when I feel separation anxiety?
Well, there you go. Separation anxiety through their spritz is only for dog guardians, not for dogs, just so you know.
This yes, is not, of course,
your dogs for sure. But this is a splash of Campari, a splash of soda, and a bunch of mandarin juice and peel from my garden.
Ooh, so beautiful. Ugh, I love that so much. It sounds amazing. And honestly, I say that the people who deal with real separation anxiety at home, they need a soother. Because dogs with separation anxiety can be a lot to handle. So I totally agree. That's for humans only. And I'm actually joining you with a similar drink. It is orange. Yeah, it is orange too. It's a mimosa, classic mimosa. It just felt right today. Cheers. Thank you so much for being my guest again. And I feel like we're having brunch or something now.
Well, we kind of are.
We kind of are. Maybe in the future, we will.
We will.
In real life. Okay, so I always introduce this show with a game, and today is no different. We're actually going to catch up on some of the facts that you shared last time we spoke. This game is called Separation Anxiety Catch-Up. And so we're going to just ask you some questions that I remember from our conversation and see if anything has kind of changed. Are you ready to play?
I'm so ready to play.
Yay! Okay. So, right now in 2024, approximately how many dogs, I think you said one out of a number last time, so if you have that kind of number this time, how many dogs are affected by separation anxiety?
You'll be surprised to know that percentage-wise, it's about the same as it was 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, if you think about timing-wise...
Yes.
Many of us were like, oh, no, the pandemic is going to like chew up and spit out dogs in the into their separation anxiety woes, right? Interestingly, though, so that was about, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% or more, going all the way up to close to 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, we've had a lot more inquiries about dogs that are suffering with separation anxiety. But the from a population level, it is about the same percentage. And I think there are several things that have influenced that. One is during the pandemic, everybody and their brother and neighbor and, you know, friend adopted a dog.
Right.
But from a population level, almost 50% or a little more than 50% rather of households in the U.S. acquired a new animal during the pandemic. So just by virtue of population increase, we're getting more inquiries, right? I think there's a little bit more that has influenced this, though, because everyone thought, oh my gosh, these dogs are not going to be left alone during the pandemic for, you know, weeks, months, almost potentially years with what has happened. And everyone thought, oh gosh, they're going to all be suffering. But I think what actually has attributed to these increased numbers of inquiries has been that everyone now can either afford a standalone camera for $30 or $40, or they can just log into Zoom and watch their dog. So people were not necessarily, for no reason other than accessibility, were not necessarily watching their dogs previously. And then they start to watch their dogs and they're like, oh, interesting. That behavior doesn't look very comfortable. And I think one of the coolest things about that is that a huge percentage, but a lot of the inquiries we're getting now are, I'm watching my dog on, you know, Zoom or on the camera, and he doesn't look comfortable. He's, you know, kind of pacing, kind of whining. We never got those inquiries before because no one knew. No one noticed. No one saw it.
Yes. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember when we spoke that you were recommending the cameras. And I recently did have to purchase a camera for unrelated to pet reason. But they are so much more affordable than they were even when we spoke 3 years ago.
Definitely. The main camera when we spoke, the mainstream camera service when we spoke 3 years ago was Nest Cam or Drop Cam as it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a $200. I mean, it was not cheap for just to watch your dog kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you can go on to any, you know, go into any, you know, big box store or any online, you know, store and like $30, you're good.
Yes, yes, exactly. And for those who, I'll shout out to Wyze, W-Y-Z-E, because that's what I use at in my grandmother's assisted living. And it's been super easy. If you want to record, you do need a little memory chip. Just know that. And that's a tip that I learned the hard way. I just was like assuming that it was already built in there. And that's why they are so affordable, because if you just want, you know, to be able to check in whenever you want, you don't need to record. They're like $20, $30. And the chip, I think, was like $30 additional once I ordered it. So Wyze, W-Y-Z-E, is a great option and definitely more accessible. So has research also been continued since we spoke? Is there more research? What has the research found? I know you've said that there could be a genetic link. Is there any more to indicate that that's the case?
There is some sort of burgeoning research. Genetic stuff is, I actually recently attended a conference about some of the genetic components of dog behavior. And the wonderful Dr. Palmer was talking about just research in general, and Dr. Lindsay Palmer, and was talking about research in general, and said that it takes, I hope I quote this correctly, it takes 10 to 12 years for the research to kind of get down to the people that are applying it, sort of thing.
Ooh, interesting.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you know. And so I thought, I scour the research all the time, but I suspect there's a lot out there that are in publications that I'm just not aware of, or are in other countries, or other, you know, are published in other
languages.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's a lot happening from a genetic standpoint. I don't remember if we spoke about this, but what had been discovered, which is pretty cool, is that there was a haplotype, which, for lack of a better term, a genetic marker, right? That's a very simplified way of saying it, but that had been discovered that was associated with separation anxiety. And interestingly enough, the more I have read and understood about that, it's not at all a surprise. I mean, if you think about, I'm going to breed a dog that has fearful behavior of any sort of variety, the likelihood that the pups are going to have some sort of, maybe not all of them, but many, you know, some or many of them will also have some fear behaviors.
Absolutely.
I think it's important though, and I hope I said this last time, but if I didn't, we're making it into this recording. Just because something might be genetically influenced does not mean that it's not modifiable.
Right, exactly right. Absolutely. Has there been any like breed in specifically that's been identified as having separation anxiety in more cases than other breeds?
So there's a handful of studies that talk about, oh, we did this breed specific research. So far, the jury is out, and I'm going to tell you why. There are some breed specific research papers. And I read through them and I think, oh my gosh, this exactly mirrors my experience from almost 20 years ago. And I'll give you an example. There's one that shows that Vizslas have a high propensity for separation anxiety or separation-related behavior problems. But then when you like look through it and you're like, oh, well, they're also based in Hungary. So that is the predominant breed, or, you know, very popular breed there. So from a population standpoint, there's a lot more Vizslas there than there might be in, I don't know, Wichita, Kansas or something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly.
So the jury is still out. I think what we are starting to see is heritability when we're looking at lines of dogs seems to be fairly prominent. Cross breeds, not necessarily as much.
Got it.
So, in other words, this mom and that dad have, you know, some sort of fear-based separation-related behavior problems, those pups in that lineage, in that line, may continue to show some of those behavior issues. But that doesn't mean another dog in that breed that didn't have those problems would produce that. So
still out.
Okay.
And do you see it more often in purebreds versus rescues? Is it about the same? Is the jury still out?
Okay. From a research perspective, the jury is still out. I'm going to give you my personal experience, because I think it's important that we hear it. There's a lot of discussion about, well, obviously shelter dogs are, you know, going to have more separation related behavior problems than purebred dogs. That is not, anecdotally anyway, from my experience, what we see in our practice. I mean, we have probably a similar amount of purebreds as we do, you know, rescues and mixed breeds and things like that. So I commonly say that separation anxiety is sort of indiscriminate. Like, it's like, oh, you, and maybe you over there, and maybe you over here. It just, but we don't know enough to know. We know so much about what doesn't cause separation anxiety, but we know very little about what does. So,
So that's my next question. What does not cause separation anxiety? Maybe like the top three, maybe some surprises that people, some myth busting here.
Love it. This is one of my favorite topics, just so you know. The number one thing that I want anybody and everyone to hear, like, you can shut this podcast off if you have to go somewhere, but hear this one point. Just hang on for 1 second. Spoiling, quote unquote, activities are not only are they not really correlational, but they're not causational for separation anxiety. And so when you are a dog guardian, and you recognize and realize that your dog has separation anxiety, the first thing that people will commonly do is talk to their friends and their colleagues and their family. And 99% of those folks, just making that number up, but it's true, are going to say, if you just didn't spoil your dog so much, stop letting him sleep in your bed, stop giving him treats all the time and taking them everywhere with you and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, letting them on the couch, you know, all the things. That has those, we're going to call them spoiling behaviors, but in my personal opinion, that's how you love a dog.
Exactly. That's dog. Just care.
That's care and kindness and love, right?
Yes.
And none of those correlate with separation anxiety. And that research actually started very long ago. One of the first really prominent pieces of research was in 1991 about it, and it's been replicated. And this is one of those things that's really important in research and in science in general, right? We can get this one-off paper that says, I found this cool thing. But until it's replicated, and then again replicated, and then again replicated, we don't know. But this research has been replicated many, many times since the early 90s. And love your dog, kiss your dog, pet your dog, sleep with your dog in the bed, all the things, because that's not going to cause or even impact their anxiety.
Exactly right. I stumbled upon a video of a dog trainer. I don't know what their credentials were on social media. And it was that you're over spoiling your pet, and that's going to lead to you not being able to leave the house. And I made the mistake of commenting, being like, that is not how separation anxiety works. And so many people were like, I know for a fact. And I'm like, that's not what the science says, because I know I heard it from the leading expert in separation anxiety that does not cause separation anxiety. Loving, caring for, and feeling like your pet is part of your family does not cause separation anxiety. I love that you commented on that, and I love that we are going to be able to share that, diffuse that on social media, because there's so much misinformation about how we need to like keep our pets down in order for them to be healthier and happier. Like, it doesn't even make sense, like, logically.
No, and as a matter of fact, a lot of the so-called, let's just say, trainers that are claiming these things often talk about the concern that the dog is hyper-attached. And what's interesting is that attachment theory started to become important back even like in the 50s, right? It started with Bowlby, and this was all about attachment, human child attached to not just parent, but female parent. So it was very interesting. But attachment theory, there's so many holes to be poked there, but one of the things that I think is really important that people hear is that attachment, when it is a positive attachment, right? A supportive attachment, meaning they're getting everything that they need, that is correlated with fewer levels or lower levels of anxiety, as opposed to insecure attachment. This is true in, you know, human relationships too. Insecure attachment, where they're getting variable, like sometimes I hug you and love you, and sometimes I'm mad at you and I, you know, smack you on the head or what. Right? Like, so
exactly right. And I'm an attachment parent for that reason, because from my understanding, the more their needs are met, the more independent they become when they are ready to do so. So I've always been, and I know my family thinks I spoil my kids and I'm always there for them. And, you know, they're too attached to me. And I'm like, who else are they going to be attached to? They're 6 and 4 years old. They're supposed to be attached to their mom. And from a pet parent perspective, who's feeding the dog? Of course they're going to be attached to you. They can't open the door, drive to the grocery store, and buy themselves kibble. You are their provider and their source of survival. So of course they're going to be attached to you. And it would be really unnatural for them not to be, knowing how our families function and how we feed them once or twice a day, how we provide for them every single thing that they need in their life. Makes no sense.
And it's real. And I'm going to just follow up on that really quick, because one of the things that I learned, this was eons ago, but Jean Donaldson actually said this, and it always stuck in my head about like dominance type theory, right? Like, oh, they're trying to take over, you know. And I always laughed at that, but I never really thought it through until Jean said to me, "How many dogs do you know that have stolen the car keys and the credit cards and have driven off to like spoil themselves in the pet store or whatever?"
Exactly.
Like, they can't. They are so, you know, they need our care. They need to, they want to go potty. We take them out. I mean, it's pretty succinct.
Exactly. It's so funny because I feel like we forget how much our pets really understand about our dynamic, because I think we don't give them enough credit. You know, like, they know who feeds them. They stare at you every morning. The person in the house who feeds them, they stare at you every morning. They want to be in your good graces. They're not trying to challenge you so that you can't have a hand to feed them. Are you crazy? Like, we have to give our pets a little more credit. Well, I have two more questions for the game. These are pretty, I feel like these are going to be helpful for those who don't know much about separation anxiety. When people call you, what is the most common symptom or sign that they're sharing with you that leads them to believe that it's separation anxiety?
Well, I'm going to talk about this three-headed dog, so Cerebus here, right? The most common three symptoms are vocalization when left alone, destruction when left alone, and elimination. So, you know, urinating or defecating in the house only when left alone. I think you're right. This is really important for people to hear, because that is changing, as I kind of alluded to earlier, now that people have cameras to watch their dogs. Those three, vocalization, elimination, and destruction, are three symptoms that are terribly inconvenient to the guardian. You're getting landlord or neighbor complaints. You're having to clean up pee and poop. You're replacing doors or whatever. Those are really, they're big deals to us as a human, you know, component. But there are a lot more indicators of stress when left alone. Those are just the ones that really are obvious to us from a, we're not, even if we're not watching the camera, right?
Right.
And so to me, things like excessive panting, pacing, drooling, scratching, you know, there's so many, you know, even just freezing and pupillary dilation, you know, I mean, like a dog that's like terrified and trembling has, there's no inconvenience to the guardian or to the neighbors or to anybody, but that's a horrible, horrible way to spend 4 hours while someone's, you know, out at a movie or whatever it is, right?
Or eight to 10 hours if they're at work. Oh no. And what, have you seen any unusual signs that people would be really surprised to learn can be related to separation anxiety?
So I'm going to say maybe this isn't unusual, but I will often enough get referrals from veterinarians saying this, you know, the guardian says he doesn't like being left alone, but we want to talk because this dog has severe GI issues or severe skin allergy type things or that kind of stuff. And I'm not a vet. Gotta say that across the board. I am. And of course, I'm not saying that I know that these things are correlated from a medical standpoint, but so many of these dogs, I'll tell you this. When I was in corporate America, I was a stressed out mess. And I used to have a bottle, I'm not joking, a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in my desk drawer because I was constantly like, oh, I don't feel well. And I was just like slugging at that. Well, stress can and often does create gastrointestinal issues.
Absolutely.
And skin irritation and all the things. Again, that obviously has to be discussed with and diagnosed by a vet, but it's not uncommon. And it's one of my favorite things is when we start to work on the dog's separation anxiety. And then suddenly you're like, oh, they have normal stool again. That's amazing. Now, and you're like, oh, so it wasn't, you know, so what comes first, the chicken or the egg? We kind of don't know until we start to make some progress with the anxiety, but I think that's an important one to think about and to recognize. And it's one of the things we track very carefully when we're working with dogs, like, what is their GI like? What are other aspects of their health looking like?
That is so important because I'm a big believer in knowing the root cause for ailments, right? And if we don't kind of know that, maybe you go to the vet and you're telling your vet your dog has GI upset, but you forget to mention that you're also working with a dog trainer because of separation anxiety. That's really important information because maybe the vet will be educated enough to say like, hey, I know this person who may be, you know, who's the leading expert, who may be a better resource than, you know, a dog trainer who's not specializing in any way in separation anxiety, so that maybe it can come back to the root being not, you know, a gut issue, not the food they're eating, not the medication for XYZ is causing stomach upset, but maybe it is just the stress levels are so high. And I think everybody has seen at some point a video of a dog having a huge reaction to, for example, noises. We've all seen the videos of the dog trying to get out of a crate or trying to escape his own home because fireworks are going off. But I think a lot of people haven't seen, you know, these subtle yet really telltale signs of a dog with separation anxiety. And like, sometimes they're so subtle because my dog has separation anxiety. It's better when she has a pet mate. She does not do well individually at all. And it's very subtle with her. It's very kind of like that very excited return from the store. She's just jumping out of her skin after an hour. You know, 10 minutes out front, she's fine. An hour more, she just is just jubilant that I'm back. So these kinds of things people don't realize could be a sign of separation anxiety. You just take it as a compliment. Your dog's happy to see you, but you don't know that they have been desperate for you to come back again because they know that you are their source of survival. So thank you so much for catching us up on that. I want to catch me up on your business and everything that you guys are doing. I want to shout out to you and your team for supporting the Texas Pet Sitters Conference. You're always so generous with us, sharing with us your Mission Possible course, your books. So what do you have going on right now other than everything you've always done, which is your books, your courses, and being basically the leading trainer for dog trainers that want to specialize in separation anxiety?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because one thing I do want to talk about that we've been working on for about the last year, I mean, it's a huge passion of mine. I mean, separation anxiety in general is my passion, but this piece has been a huge passion of mine for a long time. And that is how to support shelters and rescues that have separation anxiety dogs in their care. And there are big, big, big gaps in the elements of support and resources for shelters and rescues. We conducted a survey, started last year in October, and we've had quite a few responses from staff and volunteers and fosters and everybody associated with shelter and rescue. And we learned a lot. And what we learned is that there's a very large spectrum of, we follow up one time a week later and then they're on their, from there to much more robust. And it was interesting because it was indiscriminate between really, really small shelters and rescues that only have one or two people, volunteers kind of thing, to very large. There was a lot of gaps in that follow-up and how to support adopters and even how to look at the point of intake through fostering, through pre-adoption, through post-adoption. And we created a lot of resources for that. And I recently presented on this shelter and rescue topic for IAABC at their conference. And I'm going to present again for APDT later this year and PPG in a few months on all of our research findings. One of the things that I found interesting at the IAABC conference, I asked the audience, how much follow-up do you provide for dogs with known separation-related behavior problems once they're adopted? And it was an interactive poll, so they could just scan a QR code and then just anonymously type in their answers. And those answers showed up on my live stream, right? It was a little worrying because it was like none, very little, not anything, just some. Not too much. One follow-up call, one email, one this and one that. And there were others that did more. But the overriding predominant answer was none or little to none. We need to change that.
Yes.
And I think the reason we need to change it, well, for many reasons, but, we do a tremendous job my hats are off and I salute everybody in shelter and rescue. They do such wonderful work. And I know that, you get the dog into your organization that has, an ACL tear or something like that. They're like, we're going to raise this much money to repair this ACL to get them out. And then we're going to follow up and we'll have that business and we'll have this stuff. Separation anxiety is a behavioral emergency. Okay. It may not be medical in the sense that you can't operate on it, but it is a behavioral emergency. And I think we need to give those dogs that same level of kindness, care and support, and those adopters as well. So I'm hoping to start to educate and provide more resources that will allow people to adopt these dogs with the understanding and the hope that things, this can be addressed, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's really interesting is that as somebody who supports and advocates for rescue and obviously advocates for training, especially for situations like separation anxiety, I never thought about maybe people doing a fundraiser to get a dog trainer involved for a dog that is in a shelter environment that suffers from separation anxiety. It should have been low-hanging fruit and really obvious to me, but until you said it, I was not, you know, it just hadn't occurred to me. So I think that's exactly why we have these conversations. That's exactly why people like you do what you do, so that we can make this more of a, you know, approachable topic that has a solution rather than something that, I'm going to ask you, that may actually destine the dog for the worst or for the unthinkable because they think that there's no solution. So on that note, I'm going to take a break right here. We're going to listen to our sponsors. And when we come back, I'm actually going to dig in deeper into separation anxiety, rescues and shelters, what they do, what they don't do, what it means for the dog. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back with Milena DeMartini.
You know the expression, cats have 9 lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets. Let's talk pets. On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Covered in Pet Hair. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I'm having a conversation with the foremost expert in separation anxiety in dogs. That is Milena DeMartini. If you know anything about dog training, if you know anything about separation anxiety, you know Milena, and you know that she is just as knowledgeable as she is committed and dedicated to this topic. I love having you on the show, Milena, because I learned so much and it really does get me thinking about something that is very akin to mental health, right? So we talk about mental health as an actual medical condition in humans. And this is something that is very similar. And many times in the pet world, it doesn't get its due. So we were just talking about how you are committed to helping rescues and shelters navigate separation anxiety from the start through adoption and beyond. And I want to play a game with you. And this is called Mission Possible Rescues and Shelters, to take from your course's name. And I just want you to tell me how you and your team help in these specific moments and things that maybe adopters should be looking out for, asking for, if they, you know, if they think that they might be working with a rescue that's open to it. So the first question I have for you is, how do you help shelters and rescues at intake? And intake, for those who aren't familiar with the terminology, is when they receive a pet in a shelter environment. Might be like an owner surrender, it might be transfer from a high kill shelter, from a rescue, it might be pulling them from this shelter, or against owner surrenders or returns. How do you help that process?
So for the intake process, it's good news and slightly not great news. When we have someone that's surrendering an animal, we have created a questionnaire, which, by the way, needs to be discussed, and the questions need to be asked in a very compassionate and empathetic way. This is not judging this person for bringing their dog because they're, for whatever reason, that is what they need in their lives, for their situation. But the more information that we can gather about that dog, the better equipped the shelter or rescue will be to provide that particular animal with not only what they need while they're in their care, but also provide them with the best opportunities for adoption with the right types of fits. When shelters and rescues pull, you know, whether it's a stray, whether they pull from another organization, they grab a dog that is in a rescue that was potentially going to be euthanized, there's typically not the level of information. And it's hard because one thing that I talk to, and I talk to a lot of shelter and rescue organizations, and one thing that everybody is sort of pulling their hair out about is, how do we know? How do we know if this dog has separation anxiety if we don't have intake information from a previous guardian? And the answer is you don't. Because separation anxiety looks identical to shelter stress, and it can also not be very apparent at all in an environment where our dog is very shut down and overwhelmed. So while in the shelter environment, even those dogs that you think, oh, I take them out for their, let's say, their walk, and they don't want to go back in the kennel and they just want to be with me, kind of, that could just be shelter stress. And there's a big concern about labeling a dog with separation anxiety that doesn't have it. And there's also a big concern about labeling a dog that does have separation anxiety without, you know, that, you know, that transparency. And so I really urge shelter and rescue organizations to refrain from diagnoses unless they really have historical information.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so that's the thing that I feel like is always missing in the rescue process is the questionnaire. So this is available to all rescues and shelters. You provide the questionnaire. They don't have to make up the questionnaire. They just need to ask people to complete it.
Yes. And I recommend that it's sort of a conversation as opposed to please fill this out type of thing.
Got it.
You know, it's a kindness that we need to afford people, even though we don't like dogs being relinquished because that worries us. But it's a kindness that many people need is our empathy and compassion. So, and that is available to download. That resource and all the others are available for free to download on our website. So
amazing. Yeah, and I think it's really important that we leave all judgment aside, because at the end of the day, it really is about setting that pet up for success. And if the person is there surrendering them, they obviously are not in the best place they can be. So knowing that information allows us to find a better solution for that pet, a better placement for that pet. So it's always like the same way when I go to my district meetings for my kids' public school, the goal is the kids. It's always about the kids, the bureaucracy, everything else, the feelings the adults feel, not important. It's about the kids. And in this case, it's about the pets. How does the shelter environment, I imagine it would exacerbate separation anxiety. How do you help shelters mitigate that, if it's even possible to do so?
Yeah. So it can exacerbate separation anxiety. We don't know for sure because we don't have enough numbers and research behind that. But anecdotally, from what we see, it can commonly exacerbate some of the separation-related behavior issues. Before fully answering this question, I want to make a huge, huge sort of disclaimer in that I recognize that when we're talking about shelters and rescues, we're talking about organizations that could be one or maybe two people that are just renting it because they love that breed or they love the local community dogs or whatever, all the way up to, you know, a behavior staff of 20 people. And a volunteer pool of several hundred, you know. So not every suggestion was going to necessarily work depending on the resources that the individual organization has. The very first suggestion for those that have the resources available would be to consider foster care. And that, of course, would be wonderful for these dogs. And interestingly enough, it's often assumed that the foster needs to do the training for separation anxiety. While that wouldn't hurt, that doesn't apply to the new home. And so if we have limited resources, I'd rather put those limited resources in getting other types of support that goes with the dog post-adoption. Outside of foster, though, there's some really great research. Lisa Gunter and a couple of other folks put the research together about just getting the dog, like, hanging out in the office for a couple of hours with the shelter and rescue staff, getting an overnight with a volunteer, getting a long, you know, day trip with a staff member or a volunteer, or, you know, those sorts of things. Continue to, I mean, they're not, it's not perfect, but these are difficult patients, right? And those continue to allow that dog to kind of reduce some of that stress. And that reduction in stress seems to be contributing to their resiliency to be able to handle the environment that they're in. Really important. So we just have to do the best we can do based on the resources that we have. And, you know, I love that you mentioned that when you were thinking, I never thought of raising money, you know, or raising funds for separation anxiety dogs or any behavior for that matter. But, you know, there's a lot of things that even monetarily don't have to be included. I love, love, love when we have, whether it's a foster or an adopter of a dog with separation anxiety, creating an online calendar that volunteers and local pet sitters and dog walkers and et cetera can be like, I'll cover that 2 hours while you have to go to a doctor's appointment on Thursday.
Nice.
I mean, like, that is invaluable, invaluable. And, you know, so there's a lot of things that we can offer that some, yes, are going to take, you know, some financial resources like training, but others, I mean, getting people to help with that management would be amazing.
Absolutely. I love the idea of having volunteers sit with the dogs, because obviously we don't want to leave them with their fear. Like you said, last time we spoke, you just lock them up with their panic and leave them on their own. That's not what we want. So having somebody to just support by just sitting there and watching TV or doom scrolling for 2 hours while the pet is, yeah, like the pet's there. It's your break. It's your lunchtime, whatever. There's so many programs out there where we have people volunteer to walk dogs, but I haven't heard of anybody having volunteers to just sit with a dog. And not all dogs want to walk for a whole hour. So sitting with them would be nice too.
Very much so. Very much so.
Yeah.
Most often these dogs just crave a human, you know, being hanging out with them. And I want to remind people too, you know, yes, pet sitters charge and dog walkers charge. So there's a lot of low cost and no cost resources too. You know, college students that just want a nice, quiet Wi-Fi enabled place to.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And they're like, can I eat a sandwich out of your refrigerator? Make it, you know, make, grab
yeah.
some of your freezer. $10 for gas money or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't always have to, you know, people think, oh, I can't afford daycare and therefore I can't. No, daycare is, yeah, fine, but it's just one of many, many options, and many of them are free or very low cost.
And honestly, knowing the pet sitters and dog walkers of the world as well as I do, many of them volunteer anyway. So it wouldn't be something that they would be unable to do, especially if they take a liking to a specific pet, you know, be a part of that pet's adoption process. You know, if they're available, if they're, you know, maybe January, February, when they don't have a ton of people traveling, they can dedicate their time to that. So yeah, it's finding and using those resources, leveraging the connections that we have in the industry, in the city, in the town that we live. How do you support adopters? So I assume that because these shelters and rescues are connected with you, they know your resources, they're referring to you. Do you find that a lot of these adopters actually follow through and reach out?
They do. And I think that it's kind of two pronged. A lot of the shelters and rescues that we work with know that we provide a lot of resources to adopters. And one of the things that we offer any shelter or rescue anywhere in the world, if they want to support an adopter that has a separation anxiety afflicted dog, we will give them a $100 discount on Mission Possible. Mission Possible is $199 regularly, which is lifetime access. We are in that platform every day. People can post questions, post comments. They can ask all sorts of stuff and we respond to it 365 days a year. So people aren't alone. Our adopters aren't alone. So we offer that discount to any shelter or rescue that wants to reach out to us.
Nice.
Whether they ask whether they want the adopter to pay the $99 or the shelter wants to cover that, you know, that's up to them. But so that's kind of one place that I think anybody from an affordability standpoint could probably start.
Absolutely. And it's one of those self-guided but also guided courses. So yes,
that's
you do
right.
it at your pace. And you do it when you have the time, but you also have somebody to guide you because this isn't, you know, some training is black and white. This is not. There's a lot of gray and separation anxiety. So you want that support, which is amazing.
Yeah. And then other organizations are like, let's give this dog, you know, one or more months of one-on-one training. And some of the adopters are like, I want to start out right. I'm just going to go right in and get one-on-one training. And that's awesome too. I have to say, as much as I really feel strongly about getting that one-on-one training so that we don't continue to misstep, it's easy to misstep. The amount of success that we see through those dog guardians that go through Mission Possible is pretty astounding. I want to make sure that people know that, yeah, you might want to go through Mission Possible and now like you get, you know, you a couple weeks in and you go, ooh, I have a question. Maybe I'll just do a one quick ad hoc half an hour or something like that, to ask some questions or ask questions within the platform. We always
right.
answer that. But if it's really specific to their dog, their environment, we need to be able to look at that. You know, just, it's one of those things where I feel like if I, you know, passed away tomorrow, I would know that there were a lot of people out there that would be able to continue to thrive with their dogs based on something that I've contributed. And that makes
that's amazing. That is really special. And I think the building of community for something like this is really important because a lot of people have no idea what they're getting into. They hear separation anxiety. They're like, oh, we can handle that. And then they see the behaviors. They become bigger because they mismanage it, not on purpose, but we don't know what we don't know. And then they're like, nobody in my family gets it. Nobody in my work understands why I can't go out after work because I don't have a sitter. Nobody gets it. And then they join something like, or they find their way to you and then they join Mission Possible and they see that they're not alone and that other people have similar experiences, even though it manifests differently. It's still a community that you can count on and maybe share those lows and those highs with that really gets it.
Really gets it. And I can tell you, I've been a guardian of a dog that suffered with separation anxiety myself. This was 10 years after I had already been specializing in the behavior. But just having people that said, oh, I know you can't meet us for dinner. Why don't we all come to your house and bring some takeout?
Yes.
Because they get it. They get it. Mm-hmm. As opposed to being like, well, you just can't. We're just going to exclude you kind of thing. Like,
you're spoiling your dog. Just leave him. It's a dog. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So when it comes to education for volunteers or workers in the rescues and shelters, do you feel like there's a huge need for education? Do you find that some, depending on like, I guess, the funding of the shelter, maybe they have more education than others? Is it just drastically different depending on where you look? How have you found that kind of aspect of this? Because education is so important, especially from the top of the leadership in shelters and rescues.
It is really quite varied. And I think those organizations that have someone on staff or at least a volunteer that have good behavior background are tend to have much more understanding.
Got it.
It's a little shocking to me that there's a large component of organizations that are still like, put them in a crate and stuff a Kong and it'll be fine, you know. And shout out to Kong. I don't, no offense there. Stuff a
no,
food
exactly.
toy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah.
Shove them in a crate and they should be fine. And I want to get the message out there that I don't pay me. I will educate you. I want to you know, that you can help and that there is hope and that these dogs have tremendous ability to improve if we approach their training and behavior modification in the right way.
Okay, so you help the dogs, because I imagine that, and I don't know, I've never spoken to anybody about separation anxiety in terms of rescues and shelter specifically, but is it a death sentence for some of these dogs to be diagnosed with separation anxiety? And obviously, if the shelters are gaining access to these resources, does that improve their outlook a lot?
So I'll answer part two before I answer part one. Yes, it does improve their outlook a lot when shelters and other rescue organizations have access to these resources and understand that there are ways to devote their internal resources, not always financially, sometimes not even at all financially, but devote some resources, time, volunteers, to getting this dog into the right home, including things like screening for the right adopter and counseling the adopter. Because saying to an adopter, well, he doesn't like being left alone, is not enough. Because 90% of them are going to say, oh, if I love him enough, he'll be fine, kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, no, it's fine. I work from home 3 days a week. It's cool.
Yeah.
They don't go out that often.
Yeah.
They don't realize how often they're gone until they come home and their door has been gnawed to like pieces. Yes.
Exactly. So that education, I think, is so, so important. I'll tell you, years ago, there were some local organizations that it was an automatic euthanasia if a dog came in positive, knowing that the dog had some sort of separation related behavior problem or was relinquished for that reason. And then when we did this survey that we started in October, there's still a few people or a few people that filled out the survey. Some of them said, we provide some support, we do this, we do that. There were still a handful that said automatic euthanasia. And I really would like to get that education out there, because, of course, I can't say that this would be for any and every dog suffering from separation anxiety. But, man, most of these dogs that have this particular behavior problem are the most amazing, amazing dogs that don't have a whole lot of, if any, other behavioral problems. And we'll just fix that whole separation fatty pink elephant in the room. And then they're like the easiest, most incredible dogs you can ask for.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I mean, it's one of those things where we can't fault them for wanting us near them. We can't fault them for wanting to make sure that they're going to survive our next outing. We can't blame them for that. And it really comes from a place where they just want to be safe. They want to have stability. They want to that home loving home environment. That's what they want. So I'm happy to hear that it's changing. It breaks my heart to think that a dog with separation anxiety would be an automatic euthanasia. I understand that there are extreme cases where maybe they're a danger to themselves and others. We see that with aggression. We see that with reactivity. We see them with a lot of different behaviors that there are extreme cases, but it shouldn't be the norm. And speaking of these wonderful dogs, tell me, I know that it was Teenie who had the separation anxiety. You had already been working in separation anxiety, but she kind of solidified this for you as your purpose. How has her aging, now that she's 15, affected her separation anxiety? Is it different? Does it look different? Is it less, more?
Yeah. I hope I don't start to like get all teary-eyed, because she's gotten really up there and we're seeing some considerable signs of aging. But in the last year or two, it has affected her alone time behavior. And, I'm not surprised at all, because think of it this way. This is going to be a very odd example, but my mother, who is in her 80s, several years ago, decided she was not comfortable driving anymore. She has great vision. She's physically fit. She can hear well, all the things. But she just, as a result of aging, felt more vulnerable. And I wouldn't be surprised if, as our dogs age, just like when we age, those little aches and pains and the little things that affect us do start to make us feel more vulnerable. Whenever there's vulnerability, there tends to be the potential for increased anxiety in certain situations.
Absolutely. It makes perfect sense. Again, I was listening to this doctor. She was talking about the human brain, and it really applies to all mammals and most animals, that the brain is wired for survival and reproduction. Survival and reproduction, survival and reproduction, whether you're human, dog, cat, no matter. And it does make sense that if they feel like their survivability is impacted by aches and pains, by a reduced energy levels, that they would be a little more on edge. And I feel like that's going to happen to all of us. I'm with your mom. I think that's a really great decision to make before it's, you know, a problem. So I think it's really responsible, you know, that she made that decision. I wish more people did that. But it really is one of those things where you say, like, I get the anxiety. The anxiety is that you're not able to defend yourself from predators. You're not able to fend for yourself as much. You know, you're just a little less able to care for yourself. In Teenie's case, she's tiny, so there's also that. And she, you know, it's a little more on edge. And I love that you're talking about her aging process, because we always think about aging as arthritis, inflammation, blindness, deafness, but we forget that these behavioral/mental health, right? Canine mental health, feline mental health conditions can also be affected by aging. And it's not just canine dementia or cognitive decline. It's also an aggravation of a condition they may have had their whole life. So it's so important. And do you have like people in your practice that come to you, not like maybe they didn't even know for 12 years that their dog had separation anxiety and the aging has kind of made it more obvious?
I do. And I'll tell you, I don't have the perfect answer, and I can relate it to what's going on with Teenie right now. I mean, I think about it with Teenie, and I think about those times when I've been sick. Like, imagine having a migraine. Like, you want your mommy or you want your partner. Like,
I think of it
the same, like, there's some malaise, who knows of what nature, but like, I don't want to be alone because I don't feel perfectly.
Right.
And I think about Teenie, and when in the last year or two, as she has started showing signs of discomfort when left alone, I don't feel personally that I want to jump into a full-on behavior modification protocol and try to help her learn to be alone successfully. I feel like these last months, years, whatever, I just want to support her in any and every way that she needs to be supported in her senior years. And so it sometimes is hard when someone reaches out to me and their dog, let's say, is, you know, starting to experience some cognitive dysfunction, decline, and they're like, oh, my dog's, you know, 12 or 13 or whatever, and suddenly they're whatever, about alone time. And it's hard for me because I want to be able to offer them some solutions, but I also want to let them know that maybe this last year or two that you have left with your dog would be a beautiful time to give them everything that they need.
Yes.
They've been a gift to you. Let's give this gift tenfold back, you know?
Yes.
I always give people the choice, always. But for me, it's really hard to think about implementing behavior modification for separation-related behaviors when I know that some of that is inspired by discomfort, pain, and all the rest. Yeah.
That is such a great point. And I'm so happy you made that, because like I keep saying, is we adjust for the incontinence. We adjust for the, you know, we buy the extra expensive supplement for the joint pain and inflammation. Sometimes we just need to adjust.
Bed and all.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Exactly. But we have to sometimes adjust for these behavioral, emotional, psychological things that are going on as well, that are sometimes forgotten because there's no visible pain or no veterinarian telling you there's, you know, 60% arthritis in the hips or whatever. There's no way of really understanding it. But if you finally figure out that your 14-year-old dog is extra attached it's just time to manage at that point. I agree with you. Yeah. Well, okay. So how can my audience learn more about everything that you offer, all of your expertise? How many dog trainers have you even educated at this point? Where can they find a dog trainer near them if they want to find somebody who's, you know, certified by you?
Okay. Well, feel free, anybody, whether you are a dog guardian, pet parent, whether you are a dog professional, a behavior consultant, a trainer, whether you are a vet, a veterinary behaviorist, a vet tech, just go to my website. There's a ton of free information there for anybody to use. The website is melenadimartini.com. Should I spell it or will it be in the show notes?
I'll put it in the show notes and I will put it in the video so that everybody can jot it down.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great. And there are a number of ways that we can support individuals. Right now, I think I've sort of lost count, but it's over 250 certified separation anxiety trainers that have graduated my program. We are all over the world and we do all of our work remotely because guess what? If I show up at your house, that's not about leaving your dog alone. So everything we do is work with our clients remotely 5 days a week, typically, which is unheard of in our industry, but and you can go to my website and search by location, meaning location from a time zone perspective, because we want
to
be time zones.
Yes.
And also from a language perspective.
Perfect.
So if you have if you are not English speaking, there are a number of language opportunities of trainers and behavior consultants on the website. So you can search by a variety of different parameters.
Well, thank you so much for your time, for educating me and my audience. I love talking to you. So here's to you. Thank you for all you do for these beautiful dogs that just want a little extra attention.
Thank you, Isabel. Cheers.
Cheers. I also want to propose a toast to my executive producer, Mark Winter. Thank you, Mark. And to our audience for joining us for these awesome conversations. I hope that you took as much from this as I did. It filled my heart to talk to you, Melena. Here's to a life covered in pet hair, because there's no better way to live. Cheers.
Better way to live.
To learn more about Covered in Pet Hair, please visit coveredinpethair.com or petliferadio.com. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on petliferadio.com.